Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. When we see friends, family, neighbor, and even strangers chipping in to help people in need, that's a cause for celebration, for us and for them. GoFundMe and other crowdfunding sites and social media platforms help to propel such efforts for people in need. Yet, the Los Angeles Times found that people for asking for money that way often already have medical insurance and still can't pay their bills. Turns out, the ranks of underinsured are growing. Deductibles have tripled over the past decades, and more than half of people with insurance from jobs said they skipped filling a medication or delayed doctor's appointments. This hour on Point, those charitable drives and the deep structural problems they reveal in our healthcare system. Join us. Has your family turned to GoFundMe campaigns, charity walks, and more to cover what your insurance company won't? How well does your healthcare plan keep up with your bills? And what policies would you consider to close those gaps? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, of course, at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll go to Des Moines to talk to former Admiral and Congressman Joe Sestak, who last month set sail on his race for president. But first, America's underinsured. Joining me from Washington, D.C., Noam Levy. He writes about national healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. He's been writing a series of stories about what he calls a high-deductible revolution in health insurance, and we've been getting him on the show regularly to share his reporting with us. His ninth and latest installment, headlined, Charity Becomes a Lifeline Even for Americans with Health Insurance as Deductibles Soar. We have a link to that series on our website, onpointradio.org. Noam, welcome back once more to On Point.
Thanks so much.
So what made you focus on this, the question of the charitable fundraisers, the crowdsourcing sites? What led you to think about that in sort of this deep and systemic way?
Well, as you noted at the top, there we seem to be surrounded by sort of these inspiring stories of people, of neighbors helping neighbors, people helping each other out with in their times of need. And it struck me as somewhat amazing that we were hearing more and more about this kind of work at the same time that the nation's uninsured rate was dropping to historically low levels. It's, of course, ticked up a couple of notches in the last couple of years. But thanks to the Affordable Care Act, more than 90% of Americans had health insurance. And yet people were still turning to charity. So we decided, let's dig a little bit into what's going on here. How much charity are people looking for as they try to fund their medical care?
I'm getting notes from listeners. One writes in, it's almost as though I don't have any insurance at all. The first 1,000 each year is out of pocket before any insurance kicks in. They try telling you that you benefit from in-network contracted rates with providers, but if you check the cash price, that is the price that you pay. If you didn't have insurance, you'll find it's basically the same. When you looked at things online, did you go – I mean, I'm kind of trying to figure this out. Did you go from the underinsured to the crowdfunding source sites, or were you looking at all these appeals that you saw and only realized in retrospect and analysis, hey, these are people who are actually supposedly covered too?
So I want to broaden the lens just a little bit, because GoFundMe and crowdfunding sites are sort of one part of this picture. But
sure,
there's sort of this broader infrastructure that's sort of come up, been built in the last 10 or 15 years to support essentially people who have health insurance. And a lot of these medical charities have been around for decades. You think of the major disease groups like the American Cancer Society, Susan G. Komen. These are longstanding institutions, many of which run very extensive call centers where they take calls from patients in need of assistance. And I've been covering healthcare now for more than a decade. I remember a few years ago, the American Cancer Society call center down in Texas. And historically, these kinds of charities primarily served people who didn't have health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned, the thing that's really remarkable is when you start talking to them now about the sort of profile of the people that they are helping, you find that many of these people have health insurance. And just to back up a second here, you know, this high deductible revolution, which you mentioned, it sort of happened really in plain sight. I mean, everybody out there, I think, knows that their deductible has creeped up. The average deductible now for a single plan, for an individual health plan obtained through an employer, is now more than $1,300. Now, of course, many people have much higher deductibles than that, particularly if you have a family plan. It's not unheard of to have deductibles of $10,000 or more. Needless to say, a lot of people don't have that amount of money stashed away in their bank account if they have an unexpected medical bill. And so I think it's important to understand that, we don't have tremendous data to track, for example, of all of the crowdfunding campaigns on GoFundMe, what percentage of those people have health insurance. We don't know that. So this is somewhat impressionistic. But when you look at what's gone on with the growth of sites like GoFundMe, I think another important part of this is what's happened with the way prescription drugs are funded. Huge growth in patient assistance foundations set up by drug companies to essentially help people buy their products. Mm-hmm. When you look at this entire infrastructure that's grown up, you see that all of a sudden there's this sort of Rube Goldberg machine of charity organizations and foundations out there that are essentially up there propping up the healthcare system because people can't afford to buy prescriptions, can't afford to pay their medical bills. It's really quite remarkable.
Well, I want to get back to the question of the foundation set up and the seemingly charitable agencies that help to in some ways pay Medicare pharmaceutical costs, but also help to prop up the prices for the drug companies. But I want to do that a bit later on. I do want to focus on this notion of people raising money, because I understand, like, we all see this on our social media feeds, right? We all see this on Facebook. People might link to crowdsourcing. They might link to their to bake drives, to, charity runs is a big thing where people say, can you just give a few dollars a piece? And they try to get hundreds of people to give money to raise money for, a loved one's surgery or out-of-pocket costs. And it is because, in many cases, as you're saying, it is because it is, for the underinsured. But I do think the crowdsourcing thing online has just raised – it may raise more of our awareness about this, or it may be something that people say, well, this is, even if it's a crazy quilt solution, as you're suggesting, this is something that holds out hope. So go ahead.
No, I mean, I think you're right. And when you talk to people who are involved in the work of things like GoFundMe, people often talk about how it makes them feel good. I mean, it is, and I don't mean to diminish by pointing out that this may be a window on a broader problem with the way we finance healthcare. I don't mean to suggest that we should diminish the very real generosity that we see across the country of people helping their friends and neighbors and sometimes their strangers in times of need. The issue, I think, even beyond sort of what this says about our healthcare system, is if you choose to fund your healthcare this way, who is it who does well in a crowdfunding environment? And who is advantaged and who is disadvantaged?
So let's play a couple of clips that evokes this, and then I want to talk a little bit about the family that you profiled, okay?
Sure.
GoFundMe ran an ad on YouTube for, its service crowdfunding platform. And in one of its ads, it looked at a patient named Chris, rushed to the hospital after an accident, didn't have health insurance, medical bills piled up. Chris's wife started a GoFundMe campaign and, with the help of friends and family, raised money for his recovery.
Together with friends and family, total strangers, church members, we raised $5,000.
$5,000? Really?
Yeah.
I don't deserve it. I don't know what to say, honestly. Thank you very much.
Now, as our guest Noam Levy says, some have had success using these sites. Others have had more disappointing results. Back in 2015, Sheila Wheatley spoke to ABC Nightline's reporter Neil Karlinski about her experience getting money to treat her daughter's rare illness.
I thought that people would come together and that people would, look at this little girl on all the pictures, it's, oh, like. So I'm like, oh, well, if they, know this, then they'll definitely, 10, 20 bucks. It wasn't like that. It has not been like that at all.
The Wheatleys set a goal of $10,000 for their fundraising efforts on GoFundMe. After 6 months, they were only able to raise just shy of $1,400. What kind of obstacles do families find in being able to reach their goals?
Well, so there were some researchers out at the University of Washington who looked at healthcare campaigns on GoFundMe specifically. And interestingly, they found that only about 10% of the sample that they looked at actually reached their goals. Hmm. So a lot of people fall short. They also tried to establish kind of what is the profile of a successful GoFundMe campaign and what distinguishes those that struggle. And it turns out there is actually I don't want to say a formula, but there are certain things that are more likely to be found in a successful campaign. They often show a family who is facing an unexpected emergency, something that came out of the blue, like a sudden illness for a child or a car accident, let's say an unexpected diagnosis of cancer. People who are skilled at using social media, using lots of photos to show a sort of compelling story of the family's struggles, typically do better. And campaigns that in a way bring people into the campaign, make them feel part of a team, that they're joining together with others to help this very deserving object of charity do well. By contrast, those that have struggled, the researchers found, oftentimes featured patients who are suffering in some ways from more run-of-the-mill kinds of medical needs, people with chronic medical conditions like diabetes, often lower-income people who have a whole complex set of needs and struggles with housing, with stable food sources. These kinds of things don't lend themselves so well to the kind of campaigns that we're talking about with crowdfunding or any other kind of charity. And those that don't obviously have a great facility with social media, with using photos, with doing blogs and what have you, these people tended to struggle.
And in some ways, there might be people who themselves had coverage that might cover them a bit less at times if they have less access to such services. We'll talk to you a little bit more about one of the about a boy that you profiled and his family. We've been talking with all of you about the millions of Americans with jobs, with health insurance, how they've been swamped financially by high deductibles, how many of them are turning to crowdfunding and other kinds of charity to stay afloat. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. My guest this hour is Noam Levy, and he's here to share his reporting on increasing numbers of Americans who are turning to charity drives, crowdfunding campaigns, and the like to cover medical bills that their job-based insurance doesn't. You can join the conversation. As health insurance has pretty much dominated the presidential race, how are you listening to the candidates? What do you hear from those who might suggest a solution to a possibly broken system? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Noam, we have a listener who writes in, at 21, I was hit with a mysterious illness that wreaked havoc on my body. I used a walker for 2 years till it was discovered I was suffering from pseudotumor cerebri. Because of Obamacare, I was able to get Medicaid and stay on my parents' insurance, but that wasn't enough. Living in rural Iowa, the majority of my doctors were in Omaha. Gas, food, because you're there all day, parents having to take time off work really stretched things for us financially. Friends wanted to make shirts and raise money and stuff, but I refused to let them. Normally, tell us your story about Bo Macon and his family, a family that lives in the suburbs of Kansas City.
So Bo, whom I connected with by finding his campaign on GoFundMe. Bo is a 9-year-old boy who was born with a unique set of very complex illnesses, including type 1 diabetes, epilepsy, his deficiencies of growth hormone and other important chemicals in his body. He's had more than 50 surgeries in his short 9 years. He's spent more than 800 days in the hospital.
Jeez.
His parents live in a working class suburb of Kansas City. His dad works for a digital sign making company. His mom, who was a hairdresser, quit work after Bo was born. He's the one of 4 kids. He was a twin, actually. He was born 12 weeks early. Weighed just 2 pounds when he was born. Mm-hmm. I spent some time with the Makins in Kansas City a month or so ago, and I can tell you that I don't think any of us who don't have a child who is incredibly – who has incredibly complex medical needs like Bo can possibly begin to understand the stress that it causes. This family is essentially sort of organized around trying to make life as normal as possible for Bo. And Bo can at moments be like any little 9-year-old. He likes to play and he likes to tell dirty jokes. But you know, he has a little port in his chest that gets hooked up to an IV for antibiotics once a week. And he can't go to school during flu season because if he catches a cold, that's sure to land him back in the hospital. He takes 17 prescription drugs, and his mom is pretty busy just tracking all those prescriptions, making sure his blood sugar is okay, and juggling innumerable numbers of doctor's appointments, surgeries. He's been to the National Institutes of Health outside Washington, to specialists at Boston Children's and Cincinnati Children's. He's doing okay. I will say that one thing about his parents that is really inspiring as a visitor, as you see, these are not people who feel sorry for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to all of the tasks involved with taking care of Bo's illness, his mom has to spend a lot of time fundraising. That's not just GoFundMe. I mean, there are the Makins are very lucky. They have a supportive community and friends and members of the local high school football team, local television stations have featured Bo and have helped raise a good amount of money over the years to help pay their medical bills because they have a health plan through Bo's father's work that has a $2,700 deductible for one member for Bo. And a $7,000 out-of-pocket maximum. So every year, the Makins are guaranteed of paying at least $6,000 or $7,000 out-of-pocket for Bo's medical care.
And their budget was, if I recall correctly, stretched relatively thin for their family.
$85,000 salary for a family of 6.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that goes further in Kansas City than it does in Boston, I'm sure. But you know, that's a lot. They live in a pretty modest house. And they, you know, they economize. But, you know, Carolyn Makin, Bo's mom, was pretty straight up about this. You know, this is crazy that we sort of have to do this. And we are eternally grateful, she said, to the people who are helping us. But we feel like we're nickel and diming the same people all the time. And you can sort of never get used to sort of asking people to give you money. She said it's very corrosive.
Is this something where you talked in your article about deductibles rising, right, and that it's been this open secret in plain view that basically one way or another, even if rates aren't growing at the crazy rates they once were, rates of inflation from year over year, that the costs are rising this other way and it's really jumping significantly. Would this have been different 15 years ago under a work-based insurance plan? Would this have been more comprehensively covered and more affordable in some way?
It probably would have for a job-based health plan, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Makins would not have had to live with the fear that if Bo's father lost his job for some reason or the company stopped providing health insurance, that they wouldn't be able to get health insurance anymore. That has been removed by the Affordable Care Act, which passed 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But across the board, in many ways unrelated to Obamacare, these deductibles have sort of steadily marched up, which have sort of shifted costs onto families like the Makins. And of course, if you're healthy and you have relatively few medical bills, if you have a $2,000 deductible, maybe you'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a big accident, an unexpected accident, a huge medical expense, maybe you can take a hit of $5,000 in a year or $10,000 in a year, maybe. The people who are really suffering the most are people like the Makins who know, because they have their son has a chronic medical condition where every year there are going to be thousands and thousands of dollars of medical bills. So they are paying that deductible every single year.
My recollection was, I read this, I think, earlier this year, that the average household in America has, I guess, a net wealth of about $100,000. For African Americans, it's more like $10,000 to $14,000 in a family, I should say. And so that in some ways, the ability to stretch that dollar to be able to just pay out of pocket, you know, is a stark one for many American families. We have a lot of people calling in from a variety of places around the country. Let's start from Clearwater, Florida. Dawn, please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. I just wanted to say that my oldest son, I kind of fit into that emergency, unforeseen emergency thing with GoFundMe. My oldest son, who is turning 28 and had aged out of my ability to keep him under my insurance, he took a vacation in the Philippines, and he's a 1099 where he works, so he doesn't have – he's not covered. And
meaning, forgive me, ma'am, but Dawn, forgive me. You're saying that meaning that he was a contract worker rather than a full time employee.
Correct. Uh-huh. Correct. And he does not have health insurance. He would have to pay for it on his own if he wanted to have health insurance. So so he had this vacation out there and contracted Japanese encephalitis and called me and said he wasn't flying home and he needed help. He was in the hospital for a month. I almost lost him. And I flew out there and was out there for 13 days. Thank God for my employer at the Tampa Bay Times that worked with me to help me be able to keep my job while I went out there to help him. But in the meantime, you know, we were racking up these bills, the flight costs and the medical bills out there. Everything in the Philippines you have to prepay before they even talk to you. And so it was a challenge. And we set up two GoFundMes. His friend out in the Philippines that had worked for Vivint with him had set up one out there, and then I set up one here for the family members. And we had over $16,000 in medical bills and flight costs, and GoFundMe raised $13,000 of it. So I was very, very thankful, very blessed, and my son was able to get to a good hospital out there. I took him from the place he was in to the Manila Doctor's Hospital and got him the specialist he needed. And he's home and safe and back at work. And you wouldn't even know that he had it, which beats all of the statistics about Japanese encephalitis. But
well, Dawn, we certainly are glad to hear about that resolution. Noam, how does that fit in with your understanding? I mean, is this a viable and good solution for a lot of people?
I think it clearly is, and even many of the healthcare campaigns on GoFundMe involve raising money for beyond medical bills, because as anybody who's ever had a sick friend or relative knows, there are a lot of costs associated with traveling, even if you don't have to go to the Philippines, across town to the hospital and so forth. And clearly these campaigns can help out, and there's a reason why they exist. They're sort of in many ways a modern day incarnation of what churches and other social organizations have done for generations in this country. The question is sort of, is it a substitute for a broader safety net system that could protect Americans at least from the medical bills they would incur, if not from the costs associated with caring for a sick family member?
We've a call now from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Noel, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Hi.
Hi.
I I just wanted to share that I, too, have resorted to GoFundMe. Mm-hmm. I have two daughters, and I'm one of four children. And I have this memory of growing up. My mom's a nurse, four of us, never sitting around the table discussing, should we call the ambulance or not? Have we met our deductible? And my husband and I have had to have that conversation many times. Mm-hmm. And it, to me, in the United States of America, it's insane. And in my research, I did come across in 1973, Nixon signed the Health Maintenance Act, which seems to have been when things started to change around insurance and greed. And I do think the solution is insurance companies need to be non-profit. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if Noah has any, comment or information on that.
Noam, a way in here.
Well, I mean, it's sort of hard to identify the original sin in American healthcare. I'm not sure we can blame Nixon for that necessarily. It's certainly true that deductibles started taking off really in a dramatic fashion about 10 or 15 years ago. And in many ways, ironically, it was a result of a backlash against HMOs, which had been created by that legislation that Nixon signed in the early 70s. And there was a lot of unhappiness by patients about their limited choice of doctors. Employers were looking for ways to save money in other ways and shifting costs onto patients through higher deductibles was seen as an economical way to do that. There was a whole line of thinking that supported the notion that if patients had, quote unquote, skin in the game, that they would be more careful about how they shop for medical care, and that would drive down costs. Now, we don't have to go into all of the details about how that was supposed to work and how it didn't work, but we are where we are, where many, many patients that I talk to across the country have exactly the same terrible dilemma that you just described, of making a decision about whether they were going to go to the doctor, call an ambulance, even for a child, which as a parent, as anyone knows as a parent, that is a horrible way to think about things. Now, would nonprofit health insurers change that? They might. But at the end of the day, what is sort of driven the incredible high cost of health insurance in this country is the incredible high cost of medical care in this country. The prices of that hospitals charge, that drug companies charge, that mm-hmm. doctors frankly charge in this country are an order of magnitude higher than they are in mm-hmm. other parts of the country. And high prices for medical care translate into high insurance premiums, and high insurance costs have translated mm-hmm. into high deductibles.
I want to play now another clip from a couple explaining in a YouTube video in 2017 about an action they took. Susan and Dan Barnes founded Family Wise, spelled W-I-Z-E. That's a for-profit company in Pennsylvania which offers a discount card for prescription medications.
Dan and I started Family Wise in 2005 to help the people here in our local community who were struggling to afford the medications they needed. As a nurse, I knew patients would return to their doctor and even to the emergency room because they weren't taking their medicine. And this was often because they couldn't afford it.
We quickly learned that over 100 million people in communities all across the country face the same problem.
Now, the chief financial officer of this company told us that they don't accept any money from the pharmaceutical companies, although they are a for-profit company. That said, in your reporting, you illuminate how a lot of the charities and foundations associated with fortunes from pharmaceutical wealth actually serve to prop up drug prices that health insurers pay. How does that work?
It's fairly remarkable, actually. When people have trouble affording the price of a drug at the pharmacy, many times they can qualify for a coupon that drug companies make available that will help offset the cost of that $100 or $200 out-of-pocket cost. And then that gets that helps get the patient to the deductible, and then the insurance company will cover the rest. Well, drug companies make these coupons available in large part because it helps get the patients to keep on their drugs. The patients no longer have to face the thousands and thousands of dollars that are associated with the cost that's picked up by the health insurer. And Of course, this can help keep the price of these medications artificially high, research has shown, because, of course, patients are being insulated from that cost. So rather than choosing a lower-cost generic, for example, that might work just as well, they're stuck on the very high-priced medication that the drug company is essentially helping to fund. The other piece of this are these foundations, which you mentioned, which have become enormous. So 9 of the 15 largest foundations in the United States, as measured by giving, are affiliated with drug makers. And these patients' assistance foundations now provide more than $7 billion in essentially aid to patients to help them, in many cases, buy the same pharmaceuticals that the drug companies that are funding these foundations manufacture.
Huh. You've been hearing there from Noam Levy. He writes about national healthcare policy from Washington for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, Noam, as always.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
After the break, we'll go to Des Moines, Iowa, to talk to Democrat Joe Sestak. He's pretty much made the state his home since he announced that he, too, is running for president. You can join our conversation. To our friends and listeners in Iowa, what do you make of what you've heard? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. The Iowa State Fair starts tomorrow in Des Moines. USA Today says the fair will be ground zero for the 2020 presidential race. 24 candidates will get 20 minutes and a microphone during the fair, each to make their case to voters. One of them is Joe Sestak. He joins us today from Des Moines. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have for this former naval flag officer and congressman? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, of course, at On Point Radio. Joe Sestak served two terms as a Democratic congressman in Pennsylvania's 7th District, notably a conservative one. He's a retired three-star admiral who served in the National Security Council under President Clinton. He announced his candidacy in June. Congressman, welcome to On Point.
David, thanks for having me aboard.
Absolutely. Let's start just quickly with this week's news. President Trump is about to visit El Paso, Dayton, to mark, of course, the terrible massacres in each of those cities. There's been a lot of protest about the president's rhetoric and actions in those cities. A couple of public officials have said he's not welcome. Is it appropriate for him to go?
Yes, it is appropriate for him to go. In fact, it's absolutely necessary for the president, the commander-in-chief of our nation, to be there. Mm-hmm. But yes, I would also say that it's unfortunate that at times incendiary language has sometimes fomented an atmosphere from the White House where some people have acted upon dark impulses. Perhaps he'll take a lesson from this and understand that the president of the United States of America's most precious asset is the ability to unite, not divide, like the captain of a ship. That's what's important.
Congressman, you used the word foment. Do you feel that the president's rhetoric has fomented violence in this country?
I think it has fueled an atmosphere where those that feel as though they might act upon something, feel as though it might be abetted. I say that because, look, when we had women that came aboard ships in the Navy, and I had the first ship that tried a test case of women in combatant ships, if I had stood there and kind of winked at the guys and said, well, we're getting women aboard now, I don't think you would have had good order and discipline on that as they came aboard.
Mm-hmm.
It's how the commander-in-chief of the nation also must act. Not divide, but stay and say everyone is treated equally. And that is not what's been happening.
We've heard in recent days calls to address this kind of violence. You've heard different kinds of figures offer different kinds of elements of the issue to address. Some want to do additional kinds of gun control. Others want to approach mental health. Still others in the Republican Party are focused on social media and gaming sites or games online that contain violence in them. What policy, what actions, if any, would be appropriate from the White House under a SESTAC administration?
First, the rhetoric has to be one where we speak to the individuals and the nation as a whole, that everyone is welcome and we're working together. Second, I believe that people here in America have the absolute right to a gun. In fact, when I was captain of Navy ship, I'd invite those who owned a gun to bring it aboard, put it in the armory, and then on Sunday afternoon stop the ship and put a silhouette on the sled behind it, then slowly at slow speed let them practice at sea what they did at home and hunting and all. But I also boarded ships with assault weapons with my crew. And I don't want those same assault weapons on the streets, where when we had an assault weapons ban, the deaths of police officers plummeted during the Clinton administration. We need someone who is respected in that White House, as I was when I represented nearly 2-to-1 Republican district and got reelected while spending a dime on a campaign ad to cite progressive values of an F from an NRA to say, no, this will no longer stand, and assault weapons bans, to close the gun show loopholes in order to have background checks that are universal, because we do have to ensure that by at least this one means, and there are others like mental health and others, that we must go forward with a nation that is safer by a leader who understands this is the right path and must do it courageously.
What does the first 100 days of your White House, your administration look like?
It'll be when I announce the very first day, I will hold a town hall in the middle of America, open to everyone who can fit in. Everyone that can fit in. Former Trump supporters, former Clinton supporters. Because I think what people most want in their leader is someone who is accountable to them, above party, above any special interest, and above oneself. And then I'll fly over to France and convene the nation's pre-planned of the Paris Accord and increase as well as enforce those types of national commitments that begin to stop the world's greatest threat to humanity, climate change. And on my way back, I will announce training for a lifetime. I understand the challenge with student loans, but what about the labor force, the enlisted men and women, so to speak, of ships, those who work with their hands and their minds? We need to do what we do in the military, is we train and retrain when an airplane goes out of service. We don't kick them out like out of a coal mine. We train and retrain them. And then when I land, I'll probably walk along into a gun show and just walk through, maybe with Ollie North, who I know, who left being president. And I'll state up front how I feel about it, but I know they're valued. And finally, I will go walk into a mosque. I want people to understand that their president values every member of the ship. Because we don't get to choose who comes aboard a ship. We work with everyone, gay, women, men, doesn't matter, of all colors. And then we don't kick the can down the road. We don't have that choice in the Navy. We no longer have that choice. And if we're going to avoid having another president that can only do executive orders, the next one rips it out, if we are to advance policies for those who see only the growth of inequity, not economy, you need a president who is trusted by all. And that, as I demonstrated when I ran against my own president, when they accepted Arlen Specter, the man who had tried to humiliate Anita Hill. Today that wouldn't stand, but back then I felt he should be held accountable for what he did and ran against my party's desires. I think standing next to Mr. Trump on that stage in the debates, people will understand, even those who voted for him because they knew the system wasn't working, will say, this is someone who will be actually honest and with integrity be accountable to us. That's how I'll do the first day, and that's how I'll do those first 100 days, and that's how I'll do all 8 years.
We have a call for Democratic presidential candidate Joe Sestak calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, thanks for calling in. Thanks for listening. What's your question for the former congressman?
Yes, my question is are you for open borders where everyone from Egypt, Syria, India, Ethiopia, the farmers from South Africa, white farmers from South Africa, can come into the United States? How many people are you going to let in? A billion people?
Well, so, yes, sir. Thanks. Troy, let me ask you a question. Are you a Democrat? Will you be participating in these caucuses this year or this coming year?
I am a registered registered independent, uh-huh. and I cannot vote uh-huh. In that.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. Thanks for letting us know. Joe Sestak seemed to be a little interesting approach to the question, but nonetheless, how would you approach the notion both of our southern border, which the president's placed so much attention to, but also on the question of letting in refugees, which was a question early on in his term. He, you know, deeply cut back what the Obama administration had allowed from places like Syria and other places where refugees were seeking a stature and sanction here.
First off, in answer to his question, I would welcome every single one of those types of individuals. But I do believe that our borders should be secure. I headed the Navy's strategic anti-terrorism right after 9/11. At least at that time, I knew that south of the border there were drug cartels dealing with al-Qaeda, for example. So, yes, I get protected our borders. We're doing it so stupidly. Who can't climb over a wall? Why not have an unmanned air vehicle if they can look down and even get water to those who are crossing and direct someone for water across the desert? But all that said, I also want to protect our economy. And we know that since 1970, American women have a birth rate that does not replenish, so to speak, those who unfortunately pass away every year. If it were not for immigrants of all types since 1970, we would be in a population death spiral, like Japan that has no immigration policy. And therefore, our economy would suffer significantly. My father's an immigrant. And we need to understand it rejuvenates us with those who come and work and are really with ingenuity. A woman who walks 800 miles, carrying her child away from violence, knowing she may be raped. The bravery of that woman is someone that I would value here. And so, David, to your question, how would I deal with the refugees? We have within our government called a mass strategy plan where FEMA is aligned with the Red Cross to handle refugees from hurricanes. Why is ICE handling children that aren't trained to do so? Get that down there immediately and then get the children back with their families and have the families go where they need to be, not detained. But most importantly, militaries, I tell people, never fix a problem. They can stop a problem. And I bring that up because we can fix this problem by the developmental aid that the Northern Triangle, those three countries that are fomented into violence, need to become. That's how we fixed Germany after a military stopped it in World War II. We fixed it by a developmental aid that made sure fascism didn't rise again. And so that's why you need also someone in the White House that understands with breadth and depth from global experience in war overseas as well as serving in the White House where President Clinton has directed defense policy, that if we can restore our leadership in the world, we will be able to welcome so many great citizens of other countries that want to come here and that we need to build our economy and do it in an orderly, safe way and get the undocumented into a line. Because every study has shown once they're there at the back of the line and go through procedures like good bipartisan bills have said under John McCain, George Bush, and Ted Kennedy, that America comes united again. And that what every study has shown, we'll get more productivity and we'll get much more in taxes once they go through the process of background checks, mm-hmm. any crimes committed, et cetera. So overall, mm-hmm. we need a comprehensive approach by somebody who understands that, yes, we need immigrants to keep this economy going uh-huh. if we're going to compete with China.
Congressman, I want to do what we've done for a number of the folks who've joined us who are running for president and just do a quick lightning round, just a couple of sentences to address
yes,
each
sir.
So people get a flavor for you. You obviously former three-star admiral. So I want to ask you a little bit about our continued military involvement and presence in Afghanistan and Iraq in the Middle East. What's your feeling about our presence there? How comfortable are you with our degree of engagement?
I'm not comfortable because no one has laid out a strategy with milestones that say, here's why we needed a 40,000 troop increase some years ago in Afghanistan. And so therefore, they didn't have milestones that we could see if it's working or not. That said, I do know that we were right to do Afghanistan, not Iraq, because those senators, Democrats and Republicans alike who voted for that tragic misadventure had little understanding that I mentioned to you earlier, that militaries might stop a problem, They never fixed it, and they unleashed Shia against Sunni, and Sunni against Shia, and then former General Saddam Hussein created ISIS. Mm-hmm. That has metastasized, left us there. We need now what we need to do is deal with ISIS because of that. But in Afghanistan, we needed to set a date. In the first, by within 4 years, we will withdraw, leaving a modicum of safety in that area. Mm-hmm. It may not be all of it, and we need to deal with Taliban. But if I could, David, please. I convened the world after I left the military. I didn't take one of those lobbying jobs that 450 senators and congressmen did. And I brought 158 nations, each with a high school team, including an all-girls Muslim team from Afghanistan, who I wanted to lead the parade. And I had them at Constitution Hall across from the White House. And they all came for the inaugural Robotics Olympics. And as they walked up that stage, I said to the person next to me, if we had fixed the illiteracy rate of women in Afghanistan, which was 95% when I was on the ground there at the beginning of the war, heading the Navy's strategic counterterrorism for a very short period, we would have done more to fix the global war of terror than our military, after 19 years of war, has courageously been trying to stop it. So, yes, we need to set a date certain. We need to withdraw and have a modicum of safety and then contain any other problems. But let's not forget those young Muslim girls. And make sure we leave a modicum of safety there, because the real challenge to us is an illiberal world order that's arising, China.
Okay. Twitter-linked answer to the next two very quickly.
Yes, sir. Sorry.
That's all right. Where are you in healthcare insurance? You've heard a spirited debate from different wings of the party on this primary. Yes, Where do you land?
Yes, sir. Again, I go back to my Navy training, piss poor planning gives piss poor execution for public option. I voted for that when I was in Congress, and the Senate couldn't stand up to the health insurance industry and took it out. That public option is a transition of choice, and we see if it works towards one of two roads. I would like single payer, because even when my daughter's brain cancer came back this past year, which delayed me from getting in until recently, could not get the drug approved for her, and I would have to pay $300,000. Mm-hmm. I want the insurance companies out of the business, but I want to make sure it works. And so therefore, they have a transition choice. You either go towards where private hospitals are there under Medicare for All, or you go towards the VA model, which if you read the book Wounds of War, is rated by the New England Journal of Medicine as better in providing health care than better or as good as any private or public like Medicare. A way to do it. And so therefore, at the end of the day, I want this to be a transition of choice for those 255 million Americans like me, even though I'm in the military, that have some form of private health care insurance underneath them. So they get a choice to go into it. It proves itself and you go on.
In the 30 seconds we have left, Joe, give us your pitch. Tell us why you've been a two-time congressman and an admiral at the same time. You lost two races for Senate in Pennsylvania. Tell us why you're a credible choice for president of the United States.
Absolutely. Even though my party did put $6 million in against me, more than they put against
Mitch McConnell. Tell us why.
But the bottom line is I want to serve Americans because they are yearning for someone to be accountable to them above party, above self, above any special interest. That, more than anything, is why I'm running. Second, to provide global leadership, that we can restore U.S. leadership in the world, to protect our American dream of home like both Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy understood. And third, that if I have the trust of people, then we can move forward policies where too many see only the growth of inequity, not the growth of economy.
You're hearing the voice none there of Joe Sestak. Joe Sestak, thank you so much. He is the candidate for president of the Democratic Party, formerly on the National Security Council under President Clinton, two-time Pennsylvania congressman and retired three-star general, admiral, excuse me, sir. Thank you, Joe Sestak.
Sir, thank you for having me aboard.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast or website, onpointradio.org. You can find us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated. and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.